I observed that when I grew up in a place called Snooze Hill, which is east of East Stanwood, that Emil Eriksson, who was a Swede, had a flock of sheep. Most of us had dairy cows, but he had sheep. And I kind of felt sorry for Emil because he had these sheep, and where we had, you know, some of the cows were milking all the time, so we'd get a paycheck every month. But Emil would only get a couple of checks when he sold the wool and when he sold the lambs. And I thought how remarkable it would be for him if we could get a sheep that hibernated. You see, that you wouldn't have to feed in the winter. So when I went off to what was then called Washington State College, I thought we'd cross a sheep with a bear, which sounds like a pretty good idea. But it failed because there wasn't enough wool on the sheep end to cover the bear end. So with that, I better turn off the lights so your aim won't be as good. Thank you. And I just use this one for focusing. You see, these happy chimpanzees are observing what is going on. There was a time when they too were waited on, served food and drink, and had their homes cleaned by servants. A lot of the work that I'm going to discuss are work from our own laboratories. The most prominently that at Washington State University, but also some at the University of California. When I was there, I was director of a radiobiology laboratory and also a cancer laboratory. And I was also professor in the schools of medicine and veterinary medicine. We have modern facilities and the latest equipment. This is veterinary hospital number 2, so you must have another one, you see. So we're in the big time. In animal research, it's very expensive. The input is very expensive for a small output. I must say that I have been very envious of some of my associates. This was one of my associates at the radiobiology laboratory at the University of California. I was very envious of her because she'd go down to Safeway and get some clean spinach, cut it up, do biochemistry on it, and produce 5 papers. She didn't have to be called at night or worry about her experimental subjects. Or here's another associate of mine at the University of California, Paul Stumpf. In the middle there, he's a member of the National Academy of Sciences, a very famous biochemist. And he told me that he got this basket of coconuts and published 21 papers out of that box. And that's a lot of papers for a little input. But I prefer something more lively. And what I'm really talking about tonight is one medicine. One of the most famous men, as I mentioned the other night, is John Hunter, and one of the greatest men of medicine in all of Europe, probably, in the 1700s, recognized that there is one medicine. And Dr. Osler, who is one of the most famous men of medicine in this country, really started off principally in the veterinary school in Canada, produced a lot of research there, and because of this, he came down to Washington, D.C., and he was then hired at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine as a physician, and still continued a lot of animal research. And his concept was one medicine. And I have often wondered, with all the animals we have, and what a famous Dane said, there aren't a lot of them, but there are a few famous Danes, and August Krogh said, for every biological problem, there is probably a unique answer in the animal kingdom if you look for it. And these are most of the animals that have been utilized in research over the past years. And that's a very short list, really. But we haven't even used that to define man. The next slide is a self-portrait, which is a definition of man. And the present man is defined as something with the brains and the central nervous system of a cat, the heart of a dog, the muscles of a frog, the intestines and behavior of a rat, and the genes of a fruit fly. That's how man is defined today, because this is what most of the work has been done on. I think we can really do better than that. A lot of people feel that that higher non-human primates are the only way to go as far as doing research, that the rest of the animals are of no value. This is not true, although some of them are very intelligent. For example, this one is telling his mate, pressing this lever initiates a remarkable series of events. 5 presses and that fellow delivers 5 raisins to me. 10 presses, he delivers 5 peanuts. And with 20 presses, he delivers a banana. So these are some of the studies that are performed. The Canadians have determined that saccharin is dangerous to your rat's health. And this is what some of the people say that don't believe in studying rats, that all you get is an answer of what happens to rats. It turns out, however, that in certain metabolic studies with certain agents, that the difference between a given person from one extreme to another may be 8-fold, but for a given person to a rat may be only 3-fold. I don't know what you want to do with that, but you better think about it. This is a very sad case here. This was when thalidomide came out in Europe, and they determined that it was all right to give to expectant mothers, not realizing that it would have teratological consequences. That is, it would affect the fetus. And that's why we have many people in Europe today who cry themselves to sleep because they have no arms. They were born without functional arms, as this non-human primate is, because this mother, the mother to this monkey, was given thalidomide at 28 days in gestation. Now, as a result of this experience, it was not a matter of having selected the wrong animal, but they didn't do it on a pregnant animal. At that time, they didn't realize that it might have teratological consequences, that is, cause birth defects. As a result of this, now, in order to clear a drug, you have to test it on a pregnant animal if it's going to be utilized, anything that's pregnant. This is epilepsy in a dog. A lot of beagles have epilepsy, as do people. This is LaForest disease, and my associates here in many places in the United States have done studies on epilepsy, and we've learned a good deal about it. We got a long ways to go. But I imagine about 4% of the population is affected with epilepsy. Here is a dog after a seizure. One of the things that I have proposed, and I'm also going to tell you about another disease, I proposed to the National Institutes of Health at their clinical center, and I'm going back there again this fall. We tried to get not only a petting zoo at the National Clinical Center at the National Institutes of Health, but I've been trying to tell them what they ought to have in many centers where you have pediatric service, that they have available there a dog with epilepsy that's under control and a dog, say, with diabetes that is also under control. Because one of the devastating things to learn when you take your child in is to find out that it either has epilepsy or diabetes, two really bad ones. But if you could show them a dog that is under control with these diseases and functioning well, as long as it pays attention, or you pay attention to the diet and to the medicine, that they will function normally. I think this would be very reassuring to parents and also to children. Here is an unusual disease that most of you have probably not heard of. It's called Chediak-Higashi disease. The first animal model of it was in a mink, which is pictured on your left. You see it's albino, as is the child on the right. And they both have this disease. I guess my associates at Washington State University, who I guess were the first ones to discover this, have done a lot of work on it. One day they discovered a cow, the one on the left, a shorthorn, that was albino, and they says, well, maybe it has Chidiakagashi, and they checked it out. With this disease, there is a change in some of the granular material in the cells that affects their immunity, and they have quite a few problems. They don't usually survive for their lifespan. And one of the things that the people at the NIH, they have a center there for some of these patients, and one of the things they did for them is to give them aspirin. As a result of our work with animals, and discovering that aspirin was contraindicated because of the problems with blood clotting and so forth, that this was contraindicated. So as a result of this, for the benefit of the children at the NIH, our work with Chidiakagashi in cows and also in cats, and we also discovered at the Vancouver Zoo that there was an albino whale there that also had Chidiakagashi disease. To show you then the pattern that you have these diseases in people and also many animals, and that the work in animals can help people and also other animals. Here's a child with this disease. Here's another interesting disease. You probably heard of the Indian rubber man, where a person can pull its skin out, and the skin is very sensitive to damage. It just runs into something, and then it has a lesion. And you see some of the heel lesions on the back of this. Are my associates, and we've alerted a lot of people to this, I'm sure that a lot of diseases are undiagnosed, and a lot of people says, we don't know what it is, so they put the animal maybe to euthanize it. Where in reality, we try to alert people for these, because these are the kind of diseases that we're looking for many times. This is a case here. This animal came in, and my associates, it was a clinical case, and said, that's interesting, and so they have done probably more work on Ehlers-Danlos syndrome than almost anybody else. Here's a cat with the same disease. And here's a mink with it. You see the one on the left holding it up by the hair on top of the head. You see the one on the left, it's just like the Indian rubber man. And so we do intensive studies on this. This, you notice the difference in the musculature in the occipital muscles of the head of this. That's a muscular dystrophy in a mink. And we also now have discovered it in a retriever. And it has, for those of you who are in medicine, it's a type 2 lesion of the muscle fibers. And there are many children who have this disease, many people. And there isn't really much known about it, even though I guess 250,000 people are afflicted with this disease. And we feel that some of the work that my associates are doing and others who we make these available to will make advancements in this field. There's another disease that my associates worked on. It's called elution disease in mink, and it's a slow virus. And herein lies a very interesting story. Slow viruses don't behave like regular viruses. And an associate of ours at Washington State University, Bill Hadlow, educated at the University of Minnesota, and spent most of his time in Hamilton, Montana at the Rocky Mountain Laboratory. He was on leave in England at Compton Field Station, and he was very interested in a disease we called scrapie in sheep. They call it scrapie because the sheep really feel like itching, and they're always scratching, and it's a central nervous system disturbance. Well, one of the things you do when you have what you think is a virus disease, you take the material, like they did in the early days with rabies, take part of the brain tissue, and you put it in formalin to kill the virus, but you still have the virus there, and then you strain it and inject it, and it will induce an immune response. So you sort of vaccinate the creature against it. Well, what they were doing in England with this scrapie, thinking it was a normal virus, they took some of the brain material from the affected sheep and formalized it, prepared a vaccine, and injected it into sheep, and found out that all they did was to spread the disease all throughout the herds, because this was not acting like normal virus. It resisted formalin killing. It was pretty tough stuff. You could even heat it, and it was still refractive to that. It's called slow virus. It's a very interesting disease. And while Bill Hadlow was there, he was thinking about this and looking also at diseases in people. And he wrote he wrote an article for Lancet, which is one of the medical magazines in England, pointing out that what he saw in scrapie and sheep was very much like kudu down in the South Pacific, or something like Jakob Creutzfeldt disease, which is the disease that probably felled the former president of the ALC. And it's a very insidious disease. Among this Kuru in that population in New Guinea, what happens there is that one of the ways they handle the people that are dead, they eat maybe their brains and liver, which passes the disease onto the people and their offspring. Here you have a child with Kuru in New Guinea. And Hadlow proposed this, and that was really the basis for Gajicek's work at the NIH, the basis for which he shared the Nobel Prize for his definition of this disease, Kuru, and how they were able to then prevent this disease among those people. So this is the nature of research. One builds on the work of others. We know now that one can take this material and put it into chimpanzees and produce the disease. So that's a step forward relative to controlling this. This is another interesting disease. It's also a slow virus worked on by Dieter Berger, Dr. Berger in our laboratories, and also while he was at the University of Wisconsin. He's presently on leave in Germany. Part of his work, he studied this encephalitis in mink. And an interesting thing happened for those of you who know something about laboratory diagnosis. What you do in this case, he took the tissue and he fixes it in formalin and they put it in through various processing, slice it very thin, even thinner than bacon from Swift. And then you can examine it. Put it on a glass slide and examine it. Well, he did an interesting thing. He had a lot of these blocks in his laboratory that he'd put away that he hadn't yet sliced up for examination. And so he went back to it 5 or 6 years later. Now, it had been through all his processing, through alcohol, formalin, xylin, and all the stuff. And he took the tissue out of that and suspended it, injected it into mice after 6 years, and cause the disease. And that's kind of scary, really. This is a disease that was discovered by one of my associates at Washington State University. In fact, she did it on her PhD thesis, probably one of the best ones we've ever produced. She's now in research in medicine at Johns Hopkins University, continuing her work in comparative medicine. She discovered this disease in goats. It's a very important disease. We found out now that it's very widely scattered among many goat herds in many countries. And it had been unrecognized before and not undefined. It's caused by a virus. It's called the caprine arthritic encephalitis virus. And it appears here as in a more chronic case as something resembling rheumatoid arthritis, and in the acute case, it may kill them with an encephalitis, some of which resembles the demyelination that one sees in multiple sclerosis. So it is a very interesting disease, not only for the sake of goats, but probably for what we can learn that might apply to people. This is another associate of mine, John Kramer, who discovered a juvenile diabetes in Keeson dogs. Here's two litter mates. One of them has juvenile diabetes, and he's been working on this now for several years. Up to this time, there were a few models of juvenile diabetes in animals. So this is another very interesting model of a human disease in animals. And that reminds me that I want to talk a little more about diabetes, how one really discovers this thing. In working in a laboratory, in the old days they were trying to figure out really where insulin came from. And they thought it was probably the pancreas, so they'd take out the pancreas. And this particular scientist was working on dogs that he'd taken out the pancreas, and he spilled some of the urine on his shoes and his pants, and he noticed how it attracted flies. Well, it was a lot of sugar in it, you see. And this was part of the basis for Banning and Best's Nobel Prize-winning work on discovering diabetes. But here again, one thinks about what we could have done faster, because we knew, I guess, for a long, long time. You see, the problem was that, I should go back a step, that in the pancreas are islets scattered throughout, called the islets of Langerhans, or Langerhans, that produce insulin. And so when they were just taking out the pituitary, you see, they were doing a lot of other things, and you couldn't really take out the islets. There's no way you could extract them all, you see. But there was a teleost, a lower form of life, that had a pancreas in which the islets of Langerhans were all in one glob. And that had been described many years before. And had somebody really followed that up, you see, they could have saved a lot of diabetics a lot earlier. But it's one of those missed bets. So we have to be alert throughout the animal kingdom, as August Krogh said, for that special animal that will resolve our problem. These are two dogs the same age. One of them has a disturbed thyroid function. And these are very useful because there are many ways that one can have, there are many things that go wrong that may cause the thyroid not to function. This happened to be a problem with the pituitary, which also affects, of course, its thyroid through the thyroid-stimulating hormone. This is another very interesting disease. Some of the authorities in the world on combined immunodeficiency are Lance Perriman and associates at Washington State University. They've traveled much of the world consulting on this disease. You've probably all seen the bubble baby on television. Have you? The child that lived, he died recently, but he was in a bubble because he didn't have a functional immune system. Well, there are quite a few people that suffer from that. This is probably the best model for that disease in an animal, and it's Arab foals. And so we have quite a collection of Arabs and Arab foals studying the genetics of this so that we can help the matters, and my associates are doing some outstanding work in this and looking at all aspects of immune deficiencies, and there are many types of them, and they are defining them. And in this regard, some of the historic work and some of the great advances that have been made in medicine in recent times have been the result not only the work with radioisotopes, but the work in the chicken of all things to define what we call B and T cells. That work really started in chickens. So you can also learn something from them about application to people. And here's the normal thymus compared with one that's replaced by fat, and this is one of the problems. And that's one of the things that my friend John Kramer was doing, for example, with the pancreas, can one transplant, say, islets into a, it's a Langerhans to produce insulin to help out these diabetics. So these are just some of the things that one might propose and try. I was interested, some of our work, my associates worked on cyclic neutropenia. I only mention this because the dean at the University of Washington Medical School is one of the authorities in the world on cyclic neutropenia in collie dogs. It means that your white one component of the white blood cells in the body goes through cycles. And they're, of course, interested in the control system on that. This is a new disease recently discovered by my associates, Dr. Hegerberg and others. It's a leukodystrophy. It causes tremors in cats. We call it the shaky cat syndrome, sort of, in laboratory. It is a demyelinating disease, not dissimilar to what one sees in multiple sclerosis and some other diseases. So there's some very interesting studies now underway with this disease. It's a naturally occurring disease, and we look forward to having advances this. This is porphyria. It's a disease in people. This is a recent observation in cats. This is porphyria in cats, and you see it fluoresces under certain lights. One of our big problems today has to do with toxicants in the atmosphere. And I've been associated with two laboratories in which large numbers of inhalation studies have been performed. Hanford Laboratory is now Battelle Northwest, where Jim here is working. And also the largest and probably the most remarkable inhalation laboratory in the world is in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Some of you are familiar with it at the Loveless Foundation, where I have consulted for many years and where they're doing the best work in the world on this. And one of the chief animals for these studies are our beagle dogs. Chickens were utilized a great deal in preparation for space flight. They use them because they're bipeds, you see, and they put them in a centrifuge to check out the effects on the chickens for some of the basic data before they went to people. I've also consulted with, at Point Magoo, dolphins are even smiling when they're laying on the table here. They're instrumenting them and taking care of them. I can't remember whether that's Bus Buff or Tuffy. They're a remarkable creature, these. They used them to train to save people in vehicles that they had deep down, and also to carry tools, and also to rescue material that was expensive out on the range at Point Magoo. They're also studying, incidentally, communication in these animals. They've sort of broken a code, and so they can now communicate with dolphins. For the very busy experimentalist, we recommend the bat. If you're interested in, for example, studying capillaries and all, because you can, they're easy keepers. They only weigh about 30 grams, and if you have to travel a lot like I do, you just put them in a cigar box and put them in the refrigerator, and they sort of hibernate, and then when you come back from the trip, you just take the cigar box out and do your work. And they don't cost much to feed. My friend Kurt Benersky, I was supposed to be in San Diego 2 weeks ago to celebrate his 60th birthday. We presented him with a Festschrift on his 60th birthday. He's director of the research for the San Diego Zoo, which is probably one of the finest in the world. He was also chief of pathology for the University of California at San Diego. But what's made him famous is the nine-banded armadillo. We're always in a big fight about whether the pig is better than the armadillo. And there's no question, of course, that the pig is superior. But the armadillo has a couple of advantages. One of them is that you can grow leprosy, the bacillus for leprosy in it. So they've done some very interesting studies on the nine-banded armadillo. And also, it gives birth, I think, to about four offspring that are all immunologically similar. They're what we call chimerics, that they act like similar twins, you see? So they can do some interesting studies in them. So they've made him famous. He's probably made more famous because he has a son named Rolf who kicks field goals for the San Diego Chargers, who has also a Crohn's disease, and his son has done a lot to raise the spirits of people with similar diseases. He goes to the hospitals and trying to jolly him up. He himself has been very critical on many occasions, but he can still kick field goals. This is an animal we worked on for quite some time, and it's one of those things where you really should study the animal in nature so you can learn more about it. One of the things that interested me in this was you could probably do some very interesting studies on it because in embryology. Because the offspring are born 13 days after they're agleam in their father's eye. They look like nothing. And you see the offspring are attached there to nipples. It's a pouchless marsupial, somewhere between the size of a rat and a mouse. There's about 48 species, I guess, down in South and Central America. And we were interested then you could study embryology by watching it on the outside. They attach to these nipples at 13 days, and they have to hang on at least for until 3 weeks, and then they can come off and on again. And they have also an advantage that they have a very simple chromosome pattern. You can almost wring them out and hang them up on the line, contrasted with a lot of other chromosome patterns. And it also shows why females are usually longer lived and also tougher than men because they have more DNA. This is true also in the human species. You see the XY chromosome is smaller than the XX, and that determines whether you're male or female. I thought you'd be interested in knowing that. One of the things that have concerned us for a long time, I spent many days and nights and weekends studying the cause of cancer and diagnosis in cattle, leukemia of cattle, and my associates at the University of California were the ones that discovered feline sarcoma in the cat, which has some counterpart in human beings. And we learned a lot about that. We also discovered the woolly monkey fibrosarcoma virus and also the virus in the gibbon, in the white-handed gibbon. It's my friend, late Boyd Harrell. This has been studied a great deal in recent times at the National Institutes of Health and my associates Kawakami and others at the University of California. It probably has some application in human medicine. In fact, on the basis for some of this and other work, many people are now trying to do something about, and this is to remind me to tell you about a very confounding disease called AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, which is killing quite a few people now. In fact, one of the biggest supporters of our equine research program was an equine clinical veterinarian who died just 2 weeks ago after a couple years of illness. It's a terrible thing to watch. But now we have found certain monkeys at University of Washington Primate Center, where I consult, and it also at the University of California. I learned just 2 weeks ago that they have monkeys there with a disease very similar to AIDS,
And in fact, they have at University of California a rhesus monkey that acts like Typhoid Mary. Although it is not manifesting the disease, it is passing the organism that causes it. In fact, they made a mistake one day and put her in with the wrong pen and ended up with several other monkeys that contracted a disease like AIDS. Only they call it SAIDS, simian acquired immune deficiency syndrome. So and then they put her into a cage and separated her and put some monkeys around her, but with a 10-foot space. And then they didn't, none of the monkeys got it. So in fact, one of the people that worked with us at NIH, Gallo, is now working very hard and his associates on AIDS, along with cooperative efforts with some friends of mine at Harvard and also at in Paris. And they feel that they now have the causative agent, although this is being challenged. We now are in a position with genetic engineering and monoclonal antibodies. It's a very exciting time to live, where we can probably start doing something about changing certain components within the genetic structure to correct certain diseases, or even to come out with different kind of animals. Something like this. I did this in a copy machine. It's a lot easier than doing it the real way. But this could be in the horizon, where you sort of make the pattern for developing a new disease. If you would have told me 10 years ago that you could have a vat of bacteria producing insulin, endorphins, and a lot of other things, I would have told you you were crazy. But they're doing it now. It's an exceedingly interesting time to live. On behavior, this is, I was just recently in Vienna, Austria, for an international conference on human-animal bond interrelationships, and it was my duty to give the accolades for Conrad Lorenz for the English-speaking world on his 80th birthday. And this is one of the slides I showed. This is Conrad Lorenz with two of his geese. And we have learned, it's just to remind me to tell you, we've learned a great deal about behavior in people by studying behavior in animals, including geese and fish and other animals. And he, if you, I think one of the exciting books for you to read is King Solomon's Ring by Conrad Lorenz. Sometimes you go far afield to get an unusual animal. This is a wildebeest that I saw in Kenya. And some people in St. Louis, I think, were studying the coronary circulation of a wildebeest. And they found out it was truly remarkable. I don't know if any of you probably have never seen a heart attack in a wildebeest. Of course, you probably haven't seen very many wildebeests, but nobody's seen a heart attack in a wildebeest. So it's kind of interesting to study these unusual specimens. On the rat, I wanted to say that with rat and mice, although they have some dissimilarities, we have learned a tremendous amount of information from them. And I want to get to the rat, to the mouse situation here in a little while. But a lot of people use rats where they probably shouldn't use rats because they used them because they were cheap and convenient, and that isn't the reason enough. But you also have to use, I think courage must be tempered with judgment. I would hesitate to start a large experiment with tigers. I wouldn't be caught doing this. But relative to mice, you know I'd get pigs in there somewhere. I, of course, could tell you, spend a whole hour telling you the greatness of pigs in research, because they are like you in many ways, physiologically. But talking about mice, we now have mice that you can essentially write your ticket. If you want a mouse that shows a 50% incidence of mammary carcinoma, at 18 months, or one with a low incidence of tumors for his lifetime, or a high incidence of another kind of tumor at a year of age. You just name it, and it's a shelf item. And it shows sort of what genetics will do for you. Or if you want something that radiation at 150 R will kill half of them, you can get those, or you can get some that take 700. So we see these kind of patterns, a lot of it having to do with the genetics of it. We still have many syndromes that we don't have answers for. This is one of them. And one of the things that I would resist doing is to study that in animals. I feel it's very important that one really has respect for one's animals. And before you do an experiment, you have to examine yourself. Is this the best animal for this experiment? Will we really learn something from this experiment? Is it overly repetitious of other work? Will it cause undue suffering to this animal? Has every measure been taken to prevent pain wherever possible? And so you look over all this. You also have to ask yourself, not only is this trip necessary, but what would it cost if you don't do the experiment? So this is a very serious matter, and a lot of people today, on the one hand, feel that you can do anything with an animal, and others say that you shouldn't do anything with an animal, that a mouse has just as much right to be here as you do. And I'm in between these, so I get pot shots from both sides. Now, a lot of people feel that you ought to use something else, like alternatives. There's a great effort presently in looking at alternatives to animals in research. The scientists themselves have come up with many of these. Immunologically, we used to do a lot of diagnosis, extensive diagnosing using animals. Now we're using a lot of cell systems and immunoassays that are very sensitive. With monoclonal antibodies, we become very sensitive to many of these tests. So we've eliminated a lot of the utilization of animals. We are reassessing, for example, the necessity for lethal dose 50. That is, you do studies with agents to study how much it takes to kill half the population. We're looking at the need for certain studies studying cosmetics and their effects. So there's much re-examination here, looking at having better animals and using cell systems, computers, to reduce the number of animals required. We must give credit to the scientists that they have been leading the pack in doing this. This is an interesting thing we did many years ago. It was probably the first utilization of the kind of things that one sees. We have many advances now. The CAT scanner has been discovered since then. But these are isotopes. And I should point out that with the radioactive isotopes, the discovery following fission of development of isotopes as a result of this, and all the instrumentation has been developed since then, during my lifetime this happened. We have seen more advance in biology and medicine than any other time in history. In fact, the advances in the last 30 years have been more than all of history up to that time. And this is a kind of a case in point. You see on the right-hand slide there, on the lower right, happens to be the limb, the back leg of a dog. You see that bright white spot? Well, that's using a very short-lived fluorine 18 positron emitters. And you see, looking on the left, the same animal using iron 52, which goes to the bone marrow, you see? And you see that the bone marrow is not present because the iron isn't taken up there. But you go over there and you use 18, fluorine 18 goes to the bone, and you can see that there's a bone mass there. Now, when we took an X-ray of this, it didn't show anything at all. I mean, it just looked normal. So these are the kind of techniques that are being developed to increase our ability to diagnose. We'll hear more about this in people this week, but this is one cow produced. This is her offspring by embryo transfer to, and this is sort of a record. I don't know how many there are, probably 28 or something. What they did was to hyperovulate her and then put transferred the embryos to other cows, and they were hers. So how would you like to nurse all of those? Need more spigots than she's got. Now, all of these doesn't always work out right. You can lay your plans and make your schedule, and it doesn't always come out right. But we have, in the last few decades, made fantastic advances relative to controlling most of the infectious diseases and built a base so we can address new problems faster.